Welcome everyone to episode 17 of the Linux Voice podcast. Andrew and Mike aren't here, as you may have guessed, at least from my voice, which is obviously bad news for you, but good news for me because it means this podcast is going to be a lot easier to edit and will sound a lot better as a result. There'll be no rumbling and mic tapping and beer cans opening. So Ben's here, fortunately, so we're going to see how it goes. I've already broken all of the rules of our podcast introductions because Ben should have introduced himself in alphabetical order. This isn't really working out.
I'm Ben Everard. And who is Tapping Mike? I'm confused.
Tapping Mike. Those are... I don't know. They're both so fidgety. I mean, Andrew holds his microphone and I think Mike's usually tapping away on his laptop or doing other things on the table and this. And I really need to send them some better mics and, you know, a pop shield at least. Not that either of us use one. So I think we should say something about Linux Magazine, and you can subscribe. So, you know, we still write pages for Linux Magazine, as far as I can tell, and you can subscribe somewhere on the internet to Linux Magazine. Andrew does a much better job of that. And so I guess, should we go straight into the news? How are you anyway, Ben?
I'm actually doing quite good at the moment, yeah. Generally feeling quite positive about life.
Oh, that's good. That's brilliant.
Yeah. I may have to run away at any moment. My wife's heavily pregnant, and she said she was feeling a bit funny as I came upstairs.
Oh, wow. That would be brilliant. That's okay, because I've arranged something in case that happens. I've got a load of notes for talking about audio niche synthesizers. The remainder of the podcast. I was going to limit it to 1978 to 1982.
Is this your plan? You've just been culling the yeah. presenters one by one, yeah. until it's nothing but you and synthesizers.
That's right. It's taken 9 years to get to this point. Finally, I've just got one other member left.
Right. Shall we crack on with the news?
Go for it.
So this week, a new synthesizer's been launched. It hasn't. Well, I don't know. Maybe it has. I've no idea. So, obviously, the main tech story of, well, the year, really, is that Wi-Fi security is utterly, utterly knackered. Basically, there's a massive vulnerability in the protocol itself. So, it's not even in an implementation. So, it affects more or less everything that uses Wi-Fi, which is more or less everything. This is just about, I'd say it's as bad as security news could get, but I don't want to sort of overegg the pudding, because potentially something like HTTPS would probably be worse if that was broken. But this is probably the second worst thing that could be broken. Essentially, you should just assume that all Wi-Fi networks are vulnerable at this point. Maybe that will change in the future. But for now, at least, unless you actually manage the network and have confirmed the fix, you should assume it's vulnerable. I know that, well, certainly my router provider hasn't provided any sort of patches to mitigate it. Yeah, so I should explain a little bit more about the attack itself. So it's basically, it uses replayed messages. So when you connect to a network, a whole load of messages go back and forth as you... The Wi-Fi router checks that you're really you. You check the Wi-Fi router is really it, and you establish a encryption key. And that's different from the sort of general encryption key used by the network, or the general password used by the internet. It's a specific key just for your session, just for your machine. So that means no one else on the network should be able to spy on you, even if they know the password for the network itself. So this particular attack basically listens in when you're connecting to the network, and although it can't actually read those messages themselves, it can sort of keep playing them back, and that gets everything in a bit of a weird state where you end up basically reusing what should be random numbers, and then everything falls apart. So it's quite a weird cryptographic thing. It's not a nice, easy attack to describe, but it's really severe. It massively compromises the security of the network, and it affects just about everything, as I've said before.
Is this vulnerability in the open source or more Linux-centric parts of the implementation, or is it going to be across every kind of platform and every driver written for every operating system?
It's pretty close on everything. I mean, it does affect Linux, but it also affects Windows, Mac OS, various embedded systems. I mean, obviously, Linux is huge in the router world, particularly in consumer routers. So the Linux side of things is really important from a security perspective. But that's not Linux being more vulnerable. Yeah. Everything is vulnerable to this.
I was reading a bit about this on Hacker News today or yesterday, and it seemed that there were two problems. There was the problem with the implementation allowing this vulnerability to exist, but before that came the definition essentially of the state machine, where the very protocol is initiated between the two devices, and the state machine was never, even in the standard, was never nailed down. And in the same way you'd imagine, perhaps, I hope, you know, the software running on an aeroplane or a spaceship to be nailed down and absolutely proved to be correct. This never actually happened, and never maybe does happen in more general consumer stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite weird. This is something I actually got really deep into when I was doing my degree. I did a whole section. I did a dissertation on form an analysis of cryptographic protocols, which is exactly the category that this falls into, where you look at exactly what messages can be played where and the sort of implications of that. And one of the problems, at least, I mean, this is going back well over a decade now. And one of the issues there was the sort of tools that could be used to sort of analyze this didn't really work very well on real world protocols. Everything was too big. There was too many messages going around. There's too much complexity to the messages to really be able to understand them in the same way. Now, I don't really know what's happened to that field in the last.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I think, you know, like the Amiga demo scene and then PlayStation mod chips and PlayStation 2 mod chips and the way that technologies so often, DRM is so often circumvented. I always, for years now, I've considered things like encryption, especially on, you know, Wi-Fi connections to be probably cracked, at least by, you know, government agencies. And really just a matter of time until something like this happens in almost everything, because you can see how the process works with amateurs looking at DCSS, for example, and the way that it's so difficult with the complexity of the algorithms that we're dealing with to nail down and prove that it's impossible to be broken in principle, in the paper, in the standard that ratifies the implementation, but then quite separately when those algorithms are then put into code and then put into devices and then put onto kernels and all those kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to explain why it's really hard to make secure protocols, because it sounds really straightforward. And you sort of take this idea that even if you start with the idea that encryption is perfect, that it can't be broken, that, you know, keys can be truly random, all this, it's actually still really hard to create a secure connection. And if you kind of think about what's going on, it does make a bit of sense, because you've got two separate things that aren't connected by anything other than this sort of medium that anyone can listen into. And somehow they have to both check that they are who they say they are and exchange a password without anyone else working out what's going on. Initially, that just sounds like it should be impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
And this all really stems from the fact that when you sign onto a network, you don't go to the router, pick up a password, go back to your computer and enter the password, or something like that, where you could take stuff off this public channel.
Like key swapping parties, PGP key swapping parties.
Exactly. Those sorts of things completely eliminate this problem, but in practice, they're not going to happen. You know, you don't want to go to your router, note down, you know, 1,000 bits or 512 bits, go back to your computer and type it in to get a secure channel. And it, to be honest, it kind of amazes me that it's possible at all that you can sort of do these sorts of things. And when you look at the sort of perfect forward security algorithms, it's so close to witchcraft. It's one of those weird sort of mathematical things that genuinely blows my mind, the way that you can, at least some of the time, exchange a password without, when someone can listen to into your entire conversation, yet they still can't work out what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's mad.
It is huge. I guess it's worth saying that, you know, HTTPS and all the VPNs and all the encrypted channels, SSH, that you use, you know, through even these open access points should be safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's one thing, actually, that I hadn't really thought about until someone mentioned it on Twitter, actually, that, you know, we talk about HTTPS and all that and sort of the importance of it. And it's sometimes easy to be a little bit flippant, is HTTPS really necessary? Is my ISP listening in on me and all this sorts of thing? But it's really important to remember that it is a second line of security.
Yeah.
Yes, your network should be encrypted, but if it's not, that's another layer of encryption. And that's really important when one line encryption can fail. I mean, the chance of both this and something like HTTPS failing at the same time are small, but one at a time isn't.
Wow. The ramifications for this, I know, are going to be huge for so long. All those IoT devices sitting in homes, you know, basically their own access points.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many devices that just aren't going to get fixed. And there's, you know, as you say, there's huge ramifications for this and what it means. Because one thing that the tech community really wants is a discussion about what it means to buy a device that can connect to the internet. What are you buying? What should you be buying? You know, what's the responsibility on behalf of the manufacturer to make sure that's secure?
Yeah.
What's their legal responsibility? What's their moral responsibility? What can you expect as a consumer? And all these sorts of things. And those just kind of get brushed under the carpet so often in there. Oh, look, it's a shiny new device. What about all the people still running XP? They're not going to get any patches for this.
Straying into like maybe a slightly different territory, I don't think it's necessarily the technology company's fault, even though they may have the ability to fix it. It's kind of the wanton way people don't really take their security and their privacy seriously. They don't necessarily worry about passwords and they don't worry about what they share on social media. There was a great post a few weeks ago, for example, about loads of people putting their boarding cards on Facebook when they're going on holiday. And this was just to show that you could just easily check in or change somebody's flight or get their frequent flyer points. And there's so much of that. And this is part of it. When their passwords are, it's still much more likely, for example, that somebody may be able to see your password for your router or gain access in some other way through some kind of social engineering than maybe somebody wanting to do this. And I think companies are always looking to, make the biggest margin. So they're responding to consumers not really having privacy and encryption high on their threat level or high on their demands. It doesn't help that politicians, I always like bringing this up with politicians, but the Prime Minister of Australia a couple of months ago with the laws of mathematics, and I think it was Amber Rudd said basically, the Home Secretary in the UK, that she doesn't need to understand how encryption works to want to deny its use to criminals, and Jim Killick simply replaced encryption with gravity. I don't need to understand gravity to want to deny its use to criminals. And that it's an absurd notion, but that's what we're dealing with in encryption. And that, maybe that highlights the problem here and this vulnerability. We're dealing with mathematical models. You're not really dealing with the principles of legality or morality. Really, these are rules of physics, essentially. That's what governs, and this is the concept may be accurate, but the implementation is flawed.
Yeah, and it's, well, as a consumer as well, it's really hard to know. I mean, obviously we can say, this should be there. But, if my mum wanted to buy a smart light bulb because she wanted to have to turn it on and off, what would she look out for to know that that was going to be updated?
Yeah.
How would she know that wasn't a risk to her? And there's no way, unless you're really deeply involved in the technical community and happen to know what companies are doing. I mean, this, you know, this doesn't reported by, you know, any major consumer group. It's not highlighted on there. There's no standards that they can say they adhere to or don't adhere to. I cycle a lot, and when I go and buy a bike lock, it has got a big rating on it, says this is this secure. And that's often accompanied by a guarantee that says if you lock up a bike that's worth this much with this lock and it gets broken, we'll refund the money. And that's something there. That's why, you know, it's not perfect and bike locks do get broken, and maybe some brands rate their security differently. But there's at least an understanding that security isn't absolute, it's a scale, and that you get different levels of protection from different products.
Yeah, yeah.
That just doesn't exist in the tech world.
I think that's a great idea. But the thing that's driven by bike locks are obviously a security device. And so the thing that drives demand for bike locks is some kind of guarantee of their ability.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I don't know. I was a bit worried that we wouldn't have that much to talk about this episode. And now I'm realised it's just you and I that talk all the way through news.
I'm not too sure we've got much more to add on that that story, at least.
No, and there's not very much you can do, is there, other than wait for your router firmware to get an update or...
I think most sort of software manufacturers have responded reasonably well to this. You know, I'm sure most Linux distributions have got updates now. My Windows laptop got updated this morning. Well, that annoyingly as it happened, as I was supposed to be on a call.
But, that's what Windows does, isn't it?
But to be fair, this is kind of my fault, but I always forget it happens. It downloads the update, and then, yeah, I have to hit shut down and install. So I think that's fine. So I did that, hit shut down and install, and you think, well, yeah, it's installed. But it's not. It installs when you next turn it on. And it's... I did it when I thought, oh, I've got loads of time. I'll just hit shut down, install, go away, whatever. But then it still got me.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, this is a Linux podcast, so we won't talk about that. But yeah, so yeah, the embedded devices is where the problem is just going to linger for so long.
Yeah.
Routers and everything else. But yes, next on the news this fortnight, sticking with internet-y related stuff, the maintainer of Curl, a guy called Daniel Sternberg, has won the Polhem Prize, which is a Swedish prize for people doing good technology things. It's a monetary prize of approximately $31,000, but it's paid in krona. You get a big gold medal, and you get loads of kudos to say this chap's done all this really important work. And it's so heartening to see something that's not flashy win stuff like this.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't some whiz-bang, fly-by-night thing that someone's come up with and everyone's going, oh, look, it's great. It's one of those regular things that's hugely important, that's used by...
I know.
I wouldn't even like to guess if it was probably billions of devices, maybe.
When you sent the email with the news synopsis just a couple of hours ago and I saw this, I thought, God... I don't really give Curl that much consideration. It's, you know, it's typically, you may use it instead of wget to download files. But I know that it's used like in RESTful API access by loads of people writing scripting engines with, you know, to make the internet run and their web apps run. And then you think of all the places where Curl is likely to be used. And this is just one person. It's, you know, it's like on the good side, it's wonderful, as you say, that he's been recognized. But on the flip side, it's like the OpenSSL situation. You think, crikey, so much reliance on just one person's work, you know, and it takes this for them to get any kind of recognition. I don't know. It's one of the weird sides of open source development, I think.
Yeah, so he's employed by Mozilla.
Oh, cool. That's great.
So it's not like a, you know, working in his basement, scrounging for pennies, like, yeah, some, you know, really critical projects have been.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's, if you consider the importance of it and, you know, what would happen if Curl had a Wi-Fi-like vulnerability and suddenly these huge core parts of the internet just were vulnerable.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly, imagine if you had to go around and find every place Curl was being used and updated. I bet it's used in a whole, like, loads of Internet of Things stuff for all sorts of things. Probably, to be honest, to download security updates.
Yeah. Because that's it. You can do it, does, you know, you can do the authentication, you know, you can do everything. Cars use it. They do. I mean, for exactly that reason.
Yeah, and it's just this thing that just is there and it works and you forget about it, but it's there and it works because somebody's made sure it's there and it works.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've never realized that the Mozilla Foundation basically sponsors the development of Curl, but that's really good. I think we've given Mozilla perhaps some criticism in recent months over the kind of things that they've been doing, but that's a great thing, I think, for their ethos and for their, you know, the kind of things that they should be doing to keep the web open and free.
Let's move on to the next item of news, and that's Purism, who we talked about before. They're crowdfunding a Linux and freedom loving phone. They were trying to raise $1.5 million, and they've raised it, and I just realized I didn't check how much they'd raised just before coming on, so I'm just going to do that quickly now. But yeah, they've raised at least $1.5 million.
I didn't think they'd do it, and maybe, I mean, I know I saw the charts for their crowdfunding, and it did look like they were on target to hit it, but, you know, I know from our experience it's just so difficult to predict. I'm really pleased for them. I think it's, you know, I think it's great.
Yeah, so they've raised about $1.8 million, and they've still got 6 days to go as we record this. So, yeah, you know, you probably end up 2.5-3 million-ish, maybe, depending on how the curve goes.
So this is a phone that's going to be completely open source, or as close to open source as they can get it.
Yeah, basically. Picking hardware that works with open drivers, all that sort of thing. They're working with people like the GNOME Foundation. They're developing software it needs to be. So this isn't just an Android type thing called Linux. This is a proper Linux phone. Obviously we've no idea how it's going to go. It worries me that, you know, it sounds a huge amount, 1.5 million, 2 million, however, it's not that much to create a phone.
No, not when they're going to do the whole stack effectively. And we know that, you know, it's only just this week or last week that Microsoft has effectively abandoned its hopes of creating a phone operating system. And during the course of this podcast, we must have discussed half a dozen of other attempts to do the same thing. I don't want to be negative about it, but because I think it's a great thing that this exists. I haven't backed it. I think it's quite expensive, but it's also the thing that put me off was the 2 years I think it's going to be, or like the 18 months it's going to take to take delivery. And it's so difficult to kind of estimate January 2019. I don't know. And I mean, so I'm just going to look at the price. The phone is, $599 for the basic phone, which is, I think for a product that you're pioneering, where you need support, and hopefully there's enough money in that to fund development, is realistic, and I don't begrudge them that. It's great that so many people want to support a phone where, you know, I was just talking about consumers not backing security and privacy. Here we've got hundreds of people doing exactly that and putting their money where their mouth is with the Libre M phone. So, yeah, it's great. And I feel a bit sad I'm not part of the party.
Yeah, it's, it's a fantastic idea. I really hope they've got some funding from somewhere to back this up. I mean, you talk about roughly $600 for the phone, and I think that's fair for what you get. Yeah, I mean, if you can compare hardware to hardware and go, oh, I could get this cheap or that cheaper, but you're not buying commodity hardware. That, the whole point of this is that you're buying hardware that's been picked to be, to fill a niche that doesn't currently exist.
Yeah. And yeah, you're right.
Yeah. You know, you have to pay for that.
Yeah. That's, I mean, the thing is, I buy a phone like every 4 years or so, and I usually spend about half that price. I bought, well, yeah, isn't it? And that's what I'm finding difficult, but yeah, maybe I should. I'm feeling like maybe I should.
Yeah, I'm quite similar.
Once I've moved house, sorry, I see I've got any money left.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I bought a Moto G 4 years ago for, a lot less than that. And to be fair, it does what I want it to. And I do wonder about something like this. It's definitely tempting. If it's still tempting when it actually comes out, I'll be...
Yeah.
I might jump on board.
I'm really glad it's funded. So thanks to everyone who's funded it on our behalf.
Yeah.
And I hope it works out. I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will, because this is the same thing. I feel like with the Ubuntu phone, I mean, they were looking for something like $30 million. I can't quite remember. And they got like half of that. And I was a little bit, I thought that was an incredible achievement. Who would have thought there was like over $10 million worth of money out there waiting to go into a phone that was, you know, running Linux? That was really good news. And it was a bit disappointing that there's not enough momentum from the relative success of that backing, although obviously Canonical did make the Ubuntu phone. But in general, in the wider kind of community, to kind of either get other, get a conglomerate of people trying to do the same thing. And maybe this will happen with the Librem, is that somebody will recognize that there is demand in a niche way, because this is still niche scale, but enough demand to make a viable business and a phone like this that maybe is twice the price of an ordinary phone. But that's what you get. You get your, you know, you get the Linux stack, and you get, just like we would with our Linux machines, we pay more than commodity hardware basically for the same thing, or at least we do in time, even if not in actual money.
Yeah. But you know, certainly with the Linux hardware side of things, yeah, you can pay more to get to, you know, sort of know what you've got and know that it's going to have support on that. But you get a lot more use out of it. You know, you can run it for longer because you know you're going to get updates. You're not tied into something that's, you know, artificially end of life or anything like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it may well end up being something similar for this, although you're paying a lot more for it up front.
Yeah.
It has a lot longer lifespan.
That's a good point. Because you always end up, you know, rooting your phones and your tablets. We always end up installing CyanogenMod or whatever comes after CyanogenMod, and you know, it sooner or later breaks when somebody can't be bothered to update the Bluetooth drivers because it's all being done by volunteers.
Yeah, and you know, if it is just a full Linux stack on there, that's, you know, when the screen breaks, whatever, you've still got a home server that runs on little power.
Yeah,
although to be fair, you can get a Raspberry Pi for £30 to do the same thing these days. But
Yeah. It's still got, I suppose it's got the integrated screen.
Yeah, that's true. And there's another, I'm actually slightly more tempted, speaking of Raspberry Pi, by the Pi phone that's a Hackaday project, which is basically a Raspberry Pi Zero with a small screen and a touchpad. I think everything comes in at about £50, maybe a bit more. And it's really basic. It's nothing, you know, it's not a smartphone. This is an old school phone that, you know, you can...
Oh, it looks really cool.
You can do bits on. Yeah, it's a proper old school look. It's not touchscreen yet. It's got buttons and stuff. It's you know, far bigger than you would get it if you bought one off the shelf. But, And I'm wondering, I'm a little bit wondering about something like that, and maybe tethering it to a tablet for when I want more touchscreeny type stuff. I've been wondering about something like that for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I've been clearing out the loft space here at home, and one of the things I found was Trolltech's old green phone. It's probably over there in a box. But that was really good at the time. It wasn't that open. It wasn't, I think, just at the time it was almost impossible to build. This is pre-smartphone. But they made it open enough that you could download the open source version of Qt, and you could use Qt Creator and deploy apps to it, which is really good. I did it for a few tutorials of that at the time. It's just like the beginning of all this.
Okay.
I bet it lasts a week as well in battery, but I've not turned it on to see if it still works. And you, unfortunately, it wasn't stable enough to use as your day-to-day phone. But
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Did it have internet? Was it? Would that have been GSM era?
Yeah, GPRS or GSM.
GPRS era.
Yeah. It had some kind of browser in it, whatever they used to be called, WAP.
Oh, WAP. Oh, I'd forgotten about WAP.
Yeah. It's amazing how far we've come, but also how little we've come in terms of Linux phones. Well, all phones run Linux, effectively, I mean, with Android. But, yeah.
Okay, should we move swiftly on to the final bit of news this fortnight?
Yeah.
And that's it. Well, I don't know really if this is news, but it's something that's happened recently that I found amusing, so I thought I'd chuck it in the news. And so the White House, the US government thing, has put out a request for feedback for their modernizing IT initiative. Basically, they want people to tell them how to make computers better, or their IT initiatives better. And Oracle, big company, vaguely.
Huge company that does all kinds of enterprise-y scale things. Does its own version of CentOS, bought Sun. It's the custodian of projects like the OpenOffice.org and VirtualBox. And
MySQL as well.
Yeah, MySQL. Responsible for those flourishing communities.
I say MySQL. Most times you type MySQL into a computer these days, you actually get MariaDB, yeah. But... that computing behemoth decided to respond, and I think they've attempted to speak in the White House's own language, so I'm going to read this out verbatim. This is just an extract from a much longer comment. False narrative. The mandate to use open source technology is required because technology developed at taxpayer expense must be available to the taxpayer. Here, there is an inexplicable complication between open data, which has a long legacy in the United States government and stems from a decades-old principle that the US government should not hold copyrights, and open source technology preferences, which have long been debated and rejected. There is no such principle that technologies developed or procured by the United States government should be available free for all citizens. In fact, that would present a significant disincentive to conducting business with the US government. That's pretty strong talk for the company that its major OS is Linux-based, who own OpenOffice, or did own OpenOffice, actually.
Yeah.
And, you developed MySQL.
And much of the things that it sells and... supports are based on open source.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily surprise me, but it's actually very shocking.
The fact that they would put that in a public document is just, I don't know what it shows, utter contempt for the technology community. Because everyone there, well, not everyone they're dealing with, but every technology department that buys Oracle is staffed by people who know that the open source technology preferences have not been long debated and rejected. A lot of the world's major companies are based on the fact that actually open source works really well.
Yeah, maybe as you say, it's just their ruthless quest to get business from the US government. I mean, starting off with false narrative and then effectively being a definition of false narrative itself, it is like newspeak.
Yeah, it really does read like an Orwellism.
I don't know if there's anything that we can do. I mean, it's sad because if it does influence policy in the US government, then there are going to be huge consequences. The fact that, you know, quite often you talk about data being shared, that's been a brilliant thing in the US and in the UK. People understand the principle of sharing ideas is generally good for development. And if that can't happen in the realm of what we spend our tax dollars on, then where else can it happen? And it's so obvious why Oracle would oppose it, simply for its own benefit.
Yeah, I don't think we need to read too much into this. I mean, it's Oracle having their say, and, you know, there's loads of other organizations and people having their say. Many of them major, you know, companies, major US, well, actually, no, not major US taxpayers, major US tax avoiders, major US employers who have, you know, very strongly different principles.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will just get lost in the crowd. But I just found it quite amusing, so I thought I'd chuck it in muse.
No, it's good. It's good to know where Oracle stands if ever you're in a procurement position for Oracle goods and services. You know, it's something to bear in mind.
Yeah. If you're ever in a procurement situation for Oracle goods and services, ask them why the open source technology they're trying to sell you hasn't been long debated and rejected.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben. I think this will probably make halfway through, as we haven't got a voice of the masses and we have no neurons. But I've got a few finds, and I think you've got a couple of finds. And there are some finds on the IRC channel, one or two. So we'll move on to finds of the fortnight, 3 weeks. As you've just been speaking, I shall have a look at the IRC channel, which I know has just got a couple. A good one from John the Nice Guy. And that is hacktoberfest.digitalocean.com. I have opened up a tab somewhere. It's basically support open source and earn a limited edition t-shirt. Hacktoberfest, basically you have to make a pull request to a GitHub hosted repository. I think with some of your own code or some of your own of your own origin, and get that accepted by the project to be entered into the prize draw, I guess. It sounds like a neat initiative. I like the idea of rewarding people who may not have ever perhaps made a pull request or used Git before or got involved with an open source project before. I like this way of encouraging them to give it a go, because there are specific projects listed on the Hacktoberfest homepage, so you know that hopefully that they're going to be amenable to people perhaps making mistakes or not following the exact protocol for submitting pull requests or patching bug fixes and bugs or adding features. But you know somewhere that you're going to be welcomed. I hope that's the case anyway.
Yeah, I think that is really important, because it's really intimidating to send a pull request to, you know, a bit of, you know, quite a famous bit of software.
Yeah.
And just someone to say, you know, it's okay, just, you know,
yeah,
we're welcoming.
It's intimidating even when you work on the team and you know everyone, you know, because, you know, especially with open source, you're just putting your work out there, and especially with code. I've not done this for a long time, but you're so sensitive to how people are going to look at it and interrogate it and pull it apart, even when, yeah, you're, you know, pushing stuff to people that you know who may consider your friend. So to be a stranger and do that.
Yeah. Are you accepting pull requests on KAlbum?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, that is actually on GitHub. I was getting rid of a load of old drives and put a load of stuff on there on my account. I should try and build it for KDE 5 Plasma, I should say. I wonder if it still builds. Probably not. It came before CMake. John's also got another find, and that is a GitHub URL, try.github.io/levels. I think, if I click on that link. It's difficult for me to do it from, let's try GitHub. I think this is like an interactive tutorial for GitHub. Let me just type the URL and see what it is. So learn how to use Git in 15 minutes, it basically says, and you open up the page, it looks really cool. You've got terminals to type commands in, and I guess the tutorial itself is going to pass those commands and give you an overview of how to use Git, and by default by GitHub, because it uses the same technology, which is probably a good thing to mention in combination with the Hacktoberfest, because if you've not used Git, you know, now is a good time to get into it and create a pull request and send it up to your favorite GitHub project. Lots of advertising for GitHub there as a Git hosting service. There are other hosting services available. So they're basically the finds from the IRC channel. There was one from Tracy C yesterday. I've just had a neat find that is coming in very handy for me to fix a bunch of symlinks. The rename command supports repointing symlinks at a new target in batch. Oh, okay. For example, rename hyphen hyphen symlink 425426 Perl file star will retarget all symlinks starting with Perl file from a 524 directory to 526.
I don't think I knew there was a rename command. I've always used move.
You're right. I spend so long with the Amiga now that I don't really. There's a rename command there, though. But you're right. That's good. Unrelated, I see there's a WPA update that's coming through the Mint updater. So I guess that was yesterday. They've been quick. I've seen there's been updates for Arch as well, as you'd probably expect. And I'm sure for all the other distributions. And they're the finds on the internet. I don't know, should we take turns and find, so it's not over, like, it's not just like a... I haven't got anything massive or major anyway. I will I'll start, though, because you and I went to see Blade Runner on Sunday night. And I have to say, Blade Runner 2049, that it's stayed with me. I was a huge Blade Runner fan, a huge fan of the original. Which came out in like 1982. There was a period in my life, really, as a teenager, where I think I watched the film every week. And I would bore my friends when we got back from the pub playing it until the sun came up and everybody else would be asleep. And I'd be watching, I won't give any spoilers away, either for this or for Blade Runner 2049, but watching the end while the sun comes up and all your friends are asleep is a memory that has stayed with me. It's a Blade Runner. It has its faults. And as Ben and I were talking about on Sunday, I think Blade Runner is greater than the sum of all its parts. It came about from a part serendipity and as well as the skill and craftsmanship that went into making the film. It's a film that basically created its own myth by making so many mistakes and leaving so many parts ambiguous. But the thing I was going to say about Blade Runner 2049 that isn't giving anything away about the plot is that this isn't giving anything away, but a lot of the original Blade Runner is about identity and the idea of robots or androids having a soul and having empathy and feeling, in keeping with Philip K. Dick's original novel. And something that I've thought about the film that I've not read anywhere is that there's like, for example, in Ridley Scott's Alien reboot and the recent Star Wars reboots, this has turned into a bit of a film review section, sorry. They've made references to, cultural references to those previous versions of the films or the original versions of the films, and Blade Runner 2049 does this as well. It's, for example, the soundtrack has many of the same motifs and themes of the Vangelis soundtrack on the original, and there are other elements in the film that make references to the first one. But with Blade Runner, I think it's a genius idea. Even though I would initially, as a fan of Blade Runner, think this is a cynical exploitation of a fantastic film, Because, and the reason for that is because Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner, there's a lot in there about memories and replicants, the androids having memories implanted. And where do the memories come from? There's a famous scene in there where Rachel, in the original Blade Runner, this is where Rachel doesn't know whether her memory is her own or whether her memory belongs to Terrell's niece. Terrell is the manufacturer of the robots. And so I think Blade Runner 2049 uses those cultural references to Blade Runner as our own implanted memory from watching the original film. And I think that's brilliant, if that's true. And it could just be a happy coincidence, which is cool as well, because there's a lot of that in Blade Runner. But I think the production is playing on the idea of what we think of Blade Runner, or what people who liked Blade Runner liked about Blade Runner, or feelings of nostalgia, or even why it's popular, or even why it has a cult following, and using that within the modern version of Blade Runner to play with the ideas, the main themes of the film. And so as I've been thinking about it more and more, and I really didn't think that this film would be anything, because I hate the idea that somebody revisited it, but I actually really, I think it's, they've done a good job. I think it's good. I'd never thought I'd say that. It's not the same as the original, but it's good. So that was what I was going to mention first of all, because it was you and I. I mean, you haven't even seen Blade Runner, so what did you think?
No, I haven't seen the original. It's not my style of film, to be honest. It's much darker, much slower, and much more thinky than I like. In general, I prefer to think when I'm reading and just relax when I'm watching stuff. I quite like that distinction. But I did enjoy it. I wouldn't watch a lot of that style of film. I couldn't watch it every time I came home from the pub.
Yeah, I've never thought about it before, but maybe it does say a lot about my outlook on life. It shifts between darkness and shadowy light.
I don't know what to say without giving too much away. I enjoyed it.
The problem with Blade Runner 2049 is that you can't talk about it at all, because to say anything about it is to give it away. So apparently, despite having great reviews, it's not done very well. It's not done awesomely, which the original Blade Runner completely bombed. So I'm sure that's fine from my perspective. But do you think it was too long? It's nearly 3 hours long.
It's hard. I was probably more aware of time in that film than I usually am in that film. But part of that was because I had to keep checking my phone to see if my wife had gone into labour.
That's how long the film was. 9 months long.
That might be giving me a slightly false impression of it. I don't watch many long films. And I do have a habit of struggling to sort of engage for a film for getting on for 3 hours. Not all the time. I've really enjoyed the Lord of the Rings films and their long films.
I think that
I wasn't bored.
I think that's good. I think that's probably a good indication that the film might be all right. Sorry, that's all. I wanted to talk about it, you see, because we've not spoken since. You kind of come out of the theatre feeling a bit numb about it. It's quite intense.
Yeah, it's a really intense film, I thought.
And that's very like the original, for those two hours and three quarters, I really inhabited the world of Los Angeles in 2049, really felt part of it, which is an achievement.
Yeah, that was long. It did. It kept moving for that time. There was enough going on, I thought, without it sort of over egging the pudding.
Do you want to do a fine?
I'll do. I'll start with my follow up fine from last week. Last time I talked about some PCBs that I'd ordered, and they've arrived. Obviously, you can't see them on the podcast, but I'm holding up the camera now.
I saw you did put an image on Twitter, which looked really cool.
Yeah, so just to sort of describe this rectangular, there's an image of a sun printed onto the PCB itself, and then on seven of the sort of sun rays coming out of the sun, there's two yellow LEDs, and you can use it. Well, I'm going to hook it into a system that displays a weather forecast on it, with each ray representing a day, the inner one representing the morning, the outer one representing the afternoon, and it'll just light up if there's sun forecast for that time. And it's, I think I mentioned this before, but one of the reasons I'm doing this is because I like the idea of having more data available to me. Sort of, these are things that are useful to know. You know, I cycle to work, whether or not it's sunny or rainy is quite relevant to what I do. You know, it affects what clothes I put on in the morning, and all the rest of it. And but I don't like screens. I don't like looking at my phone. I don't like, you know, I know people do things like the magic mirror or mount displays. I don't like that. And I like the retroness of having flashing lights mounted at a point. You know, I think of it a little bit like the weather version of the old-fashioned sort of maps you saw in films, the little lights flashing as they moved around the map and that sort of thing. And I don't know, there's something much more physical about it than a screen. It doesn't go black when it turns off. It's still there. The image is somehow more permanent.
Yeah.
The device itself just takes communication over I2S, which is just a sort of low-level communications standard. So you could use it with a Raspberry Pi, you could use it with an Arduino, or pretty much anything, really. It all basically worked first time, which was absolutely stunning to me. The only issue with it is I put the wrong sized holes in it, so I can't actually solder the wires through the holes. And these are the sort of the wires that go off to connect it to whatever drives it. So I've had to sort of surface mount them and just solder them on one side. Yeah. Which is annoying, but doesn't really affect it too much. And other than that, it was one of those things where I soldered it up and I was like, it's not going to work. And I'd completely redesigned myself to the fact that it wasn't going to work. And obviously I've got a lot going on at the moment. I wasn't sure if I had time to fix it. And I almost didn't want to solder it up because I was like, I don't want to know what the problem's going to be. I don't have to, because bug fixing hardware takes so much longer than bug fixing software. And you've got to get a multimeter out and you're sort of checking through it and trying to work out what the schematic is, what the schematic you've actually done is. If it's an issue with your soldering or a fundamental issue with one of those. But I just soldered it up and it worked. And it was like, wow. And it just blew my tiny little mind.
Did you use KiCad or something?
Yeah, I used KiCad. There's a load of sort of software available. I just sort of naturally gravitate towards the open source option, which is KiCad. It's not super easy to use, but it didn't take long to pick it up. Yeah, and there's plenty of information out there for learning it.
Does it do? I'd love to do something like this, but so I'm completely ignorant of it. But does it help you get the spacing right for the traces and also for spacing the stuff for standard components? Like if you were connecting, I don't know, you know, a pin header or something.
Yeah. So sort of very loosely, the way you do it is you draw your schematic, which just shows you what you want on there. I want resistor here, LED there, whatever. Then you, with each of the components on there, you associate it with a physical thing. So you might say there's going to be a resistor there in the schematic, and in the thing you say, okay, it's going to be a 3mm resistor with this size wire or whatever. And there's just a big library of stuff you can select.
Right.
Same with LEDs. So even the chip itself was on there. So when I did the schematic, I just connected, the power line on the chip to the power, and then I could just say, okay, that's that chip, and then in the physical layout, that the right pin was connected to the power.
Yeah.
So when I say connected, it's more like a ghost of a connection. It knows that it needs to get there, but you need to draw on the trace, and then it sort of checks that what you've drawn on is the same as what the schematic is. The challenge isn't the actual layout. The challenge is learning to use the software, I'd say, at least at this level. There may well be stuff you can do to mess up, sort of not spacing things properly. I didn't manage to mess that up. I don't know if that's serendipity or there was something in the tool stopping me doing it.
Yeah. It looks really neat. You should share the KiCad file.
I'm more than happy to. It's just that the fact that I've got the holes the wrong size in it that stops me at the moment. But yeah, anyway, I got it printed at Osh Park, which is an American sort of small-scale PCB printer. They do worldwide shipping. And actually, one of the guys from Osh Park listened to the last podcast and said, yeah, full disclosure about me talking about this. They've given me some money off future things in exchange for talking about. But that's genuinely not what I'm talking about on the project. I'm really excited. I wasn't expected. That was a nice little surprise. And I'm super excited about it.
That's awesome. And, that is really cool. I really must try something like that.
I don't do a lot of sort of circuitry hardware. I've done, you know, a reasonable amount of plugging stuff in and out of Arduinos and that sort of stuff. And I've done a little bit of breadboarding and that sort of thing. And I think as long as you're sort of modest with what you start with, it's really achievable.
Yeah.
You know, if you sort of jump in and you think, oh, my first project's going to do everything. And you know, from developing software, it's so easy to get feature creep. That little, oh, I'll just add that. I'll just add that. I'll just add that. And suddenly you've just got a mind bogglingly complex thing.
Yeah,
with this, I was really clear. I'd create one PCB for this, and then there's going to be another PCB that does that, another PCB that does that, and I build it up one bit at a time.
Yeah.
And
I've done quite a lot of electronic stuff. I've built synthesizers by buying the PCBs and then buying all the components separately, and I fixed my Korg Poly 6 after some battery acid leakage and retracing it. But I still can't make... Despite knowing some of the basic principles, I can't make the mental leap into, well, like the equivalent of programming, whatever it is, building my own circuits. Other than I could probably do it with a controller and some LEDs, and that is actually quite exciting. I do find the idea quite neat. Yeah.
Yeah. From a sort of electronics perspective, it's quite a boring circuit. It's basically just wiring up a load of LEDs to chips on a pin.
Yeah. Yeah. But
it's physical, it's there.
Yeah. I agree with you about screens and stuff like that. Anything that can get us away from looking at our phones. Yeah. I have got a geeky audio find that I'll just talk briefly about. Let me see if I can find the tab. It's called... I've now got 100 tabs open. Oh, I will mention the John the Nice Guy's link into the GitHub training tutorial thing. I was going to mention openvim.com, which is another kind of interactive Vim learning tool. You do it online. It basically steps you through 20 different chapters where you interactively type on your keyboard and it tells you what to do and it tells you what it's asking for. We've talked in the past about games and things like that to try and teach you Vim key bindings. But this, I found this, well, I've just going through it. I'm not great at Vim. I probably know about 1% of the commands in Vim, but it's enough for me to feel proficient enough in Vim. And this basically covers everything that I know. Which I think is a really good starter to it. Because I think now one of my finds is going to be the release of Qt Browser 1.0. And this is a browser I've talked a lot about over perhaps the last 18 months. It's the browser that I use every day. It's basically a very simple Python minimal browser, written in Python, minimal browser, uses PyQt and Vim bindings to navigate the web with the home row on your keyboard. I'm not a touch typist, mostly, but keeping your fingers on the home row and not reaching over to the mouse, it's a really good way to work and a good way to work on the internet if you're using the browser. 1.0 has got some major changes in it in that it uses Qt WebKit and Web Engine, and it's also overhauled the configuration system. Both of those are the results of successful crowdfunding campaigns that Qt Browser has done. You can insert, both Chrome and Firefox have Vim add-ons, Vim-alike add-ons that you can use. And I use those too on those browsers. But Qt Browser is so well integrated with the commands. It's got an interactive command mode that with auto completion, you can tab through the various commands they appear. There's an interactive help system. There's a really powerful configuration system that lets you change everything about it, the way everything looks, the font sizes, the way things are rendered. There's an integrated kind of blacklist ad blocker. Now that it runs on a really modern web framework, there are no sites complain about it. It doesn't take much memory. It loads instantly, and it's a great browser. And it just so happens to use Vim keyboard shortcuts. And I really like the way that Vim bindings, I suppose, if you look for it, when you've learned those kind of basic 19 or 20 chapters, 1% maybe of its total, those bindings you can take to so many other places. You can take to Qt Browser or add-ons to Chrome, and you can use it. And, well, they're all over lots of different tools you can find that have installed Vim bindings. And I suppose, like learning touch typing, I think Vim is becoming a great shortcut to being able to control software, even though the software isn't necessarily anything to do with web and text editing.
You've spoken about this a few times. One thing that's always confused me, and I probably should have asked before, is you always talk about having Vim key bindings. How does that translate to a web browser?
So, I mean, the obvious one is that you normally use JK for going up and down, and HL for going left and right. The kind of things you don't think about when you're using Vim, although you can use the cursor keys as well as you can in Vim.
So that's for scrolling up and down and left and right.
You can forward slash search. Shift and H will go back a page. Shift and O will open a new tab. So in Vim, these are the equivalents of opening a new file. O will open a page in the same tab. Tap double Y twice, it will yank a URL. Tap P, it'll paste. These are the same commands you'd find in Vim. Pressing Shift and colon will put you into command mode. You can quit, you can type save. You can bring up some of the same commands that way. You can change shortcuts and create macros in the same way you can with Vim. What are the other ones that I use commonly? Delete for deleting a tab, pressing D. Insert mode will, so it, by default, it won't be in insert mode. So it doesn't automatically type in fields such as the Google search field. You have to type I to go into that, or press escape to leave it. Control V will turn you into pass through mode. So basically, if you're already familiar with Vim, you'll just find they intuitively kind of match to, they don't all match. For example, there are no splits, which actually would be a really cool function. It'd be nice if you could split Qt Browser, but you can't. I think that's probably just too difficult to implement with a single developer. But that'd be if you could, it would be implemented in exactly the same way that it is in Vim, colon SP or whatever it happens to be. It's not turning the web browser into a text editor, but it's the things that kind of intuitively have a common function, they do the same thing.
And it
is cool once you get used to it. You miss, because there's, I don't know the specific key bindings for Firefox, for example. I used to have some idea of what they were, but Control and T to open a new tab, for example, and Control and W to close a tab. But you don't have to relearn all those things with different applications.
Yeah.
So that was one of my finds. Where's that tab for the synthesizer? That's right. So it's called Fragment, and I won't talk too much about it, but it's basically an online, collaborative, granular, real-time coded synthesizer. It's open source, which is why I'm mentioning it, and there are dev packages available as well as the GitHub source code.
When you talk about a real-time collaborative synthesizer, does that mean there's music playing and multiple people interacting with the music as it plays?
So I've not tried that part of it, but there are different. There are loads of weird, innovative aspects to this. The real-time coding is, so the real-time collaboration part is one, I guess, and that's because the sounds are created with code. I don't know what code it is actually. I've not looked. It looks kind of JavaScript-like, but you type in things or you change parameter values. Even though you can install the packages locally, it's basically you access the application itself through Chrome or Firefox. Firefox lacks MIDI support, unfortunately. It uses the GLSL library to implement the sound and the visuals. The visuals are a big part of it, because the granular part of what it does is that it takes a granular synthesizer, takes small kind of atoms, elements out of a sound, and repeats them at different pitches. But it does that in what's known as a cloud, so a pocket of those grains, repeating them all over and over and over. So what that generally does is creates a texture based on an original sound source, or an image, in fact, and that becomes a grain. So you get something of the timbre of a sound or a source, but without it actually being a sample. It's quite cool when you start to listen to granular synthesizers, especially with voice. You kind of get the phonemes and stuff like that, but you don't get it as a recognizable sound. And it does this with images. It's got really nice output, and it's really cool. It's really nice to play with. You can play with it just by joining up, entering in a random password on their website, but you can also download it and run it locally. So that was my niche, the next find. I think I've got other things as well, but I realise now I've talked for far too long. Like, it's over an hour now, and it's just the two of us.
Yeah, I think we're going more geeky with our Andrew and Mike to level us out. Because my next find's even geekier than my first find.
Oh, can it be smoked cheese?
Oh, I have been smoking cheese this week. But that wasn't actually my find.
It sounds amazing.
So yeah, well, my other find is another hardware find. I've been making lots of circuits recently, and this one isn't one I designed. It's by a thing called Boldport, which is, you sign up there and every month they send you a kit that you can make. But the kits are, I don't know how to describe them. They're sort of part art, part electronics, part engineering-y things, part of electronics engineering-y things, parts, I don't know. You can go and check them out on boldport.club. And this month's one is called the Monarch, and it's a butterfly. And it's made up of two chunks of PCB, each one being a wing, and they're stuck together by a series of chips down the middle, forming like the body of the butterfly. The legs are resistors, but they're pairs of resistors soldered at the end. So the sort of foot joins the two resistors together. So they look decorative, but they are actually part of the circuit as well. And I'll just turn it on. So there's a load of LEDs, there's 8 LEDs on the wings.
Wow.
And when you press the two antenna together, the LEDs flicker. But what's interesting is it looks quite nice, and it works.
It looks fantastic. So it looks like a fluttering kind of schizophrenic butterfly.
Yeah. So the way it generates the thing, so it's entirely, there's no sort of microcontroller or anything else in it. So the three chips are a 555 timer, a flip-flop, or a series of 8 flip-flops in one chip, and a series of... it's one of the logic gates. I meant to look it up. I think it's an AND gate. So they've created a pseudo random number generator using discrete components. And the way it works is, obviously, well, when you turn it on, it fires up the flip flops, and flip flops turn on. And this is all getting quite electronics. For the purpose of this, flip-flops are basically bits of memory. There's 8 bits of memory in it, and flip-flops can do other things, but they're being used here as memory. When you turn them on, they turn on to an indeterminate state. So some just happen to be high, some happen to be low. And you can see, if I just turn it on and off a few different times, you get a different pattern every time. And the flip-flops are arranged in a shift register. So every clock cycle, the bit of memory from bit 1 goes to bit 2, the bit of memory from bit 2 goes to bit 3, etc. And then I think the AND gates, I did forget to look up the schematic, that feeds back into the start of bit 0. So I think it's bit 3 and 5 are ANDed together with bit 7 or something like that. And that particular configuration was chosen because it completely enumerates the whole of the 8-bit range.
Right.
Although not in sequence, it just sort of, so it's very pseudo randomy, but generated with just the
but better, yeah, just, better than WPA.
Yeah. So yeah, each month you get one of these, and the sort of process of creating them is quite open. There's a Slack group that you join when you become a member and you talk about it. And I think the actual design files are open as well, although it's quite hard to actually get them printed because this particular one has a 2-colour solder mask.
Oh, yeah.
With the
butterfly pattern.
Yeah, so... Yeah, with the butterfly pattern, which I think is quite hard to persuade manufacturers to actually produce. But it's a really interesting little project. I've been super excited about playing with that the last week or so. It's one of those things I find it a little bit hard to explain because on the face of it, once it's created, all it is something that flickers when you press two wires together. Yeah. But at the same time, it's... You know completely how it works. You can look at the schematics. You've built it. It's, to be fair, this one was actually quite hard to solder because the two panels joined at the chips bend slightly up, and there's some jumpers to take data from one side of the PCB to the other, and they had to be, the whole thing had to be held in place while those were soldered to create the angle of the wings. And to be fair, I'm not a brilliant solderer. I'm sort of decidedly mediocre at it. And I managed to solder in the last component I connected was the battery holder, and I soldered it in upside down really annoyingly. And I don't even know where my desolderer is at the moment, so I had to sort of try and pry that off with a pair of pliers while I heated it up. It was really awkward, but it did work.
It looks good. It looks good from here. So is this like, I love the idea of the monthly, a small kit every month.
Yeah. They vary a lot. They're not always even soldered things, I think.
Right. Okay.
And you can sort of see upcoming ones. So I said the development's reasonably open. You know, there's a sort of, I think they're on GitHub, and I think there's a sort of repository where you can see the next few being developed. Although I haven't had time to go and have too much of a poke about.
Do you know how much, can you remember how much it costs? It seems like a great Christmas present, for example.
So you have to sign up for at least 3 months. I'm trying to remember the three. I think it was £45 for three months.
So
it's not super cheap, but it's
not too bad considering the kits that you get. Somebody like Pimeroni should do something like that. They'd be great. Monthly kits.
I think it's a phenomenal amount of work to actually make interesting monthly kits. And gets, because something like this, and obviously I'm no electronics expert, but it appeals to a huge range of people. It's quite an interesting challenge to solder it together in the first place. It's quite interesting the way it works. And it looks great as well.
Brilliant. Thanks, Ben. I think that's got to bring us to the end, hasn't it? We have no neurons, and we've rambled on for a long time.
Yeah, I think it's in danger of going too geek if we go on much longer. Yeah,
so let's hope either Michael and Andrew or both of them together can make it next time.
Yes.
If not, then we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks for listening, everyone. We'll hopefully speak to you again in a couple of weeks' time. Thanks,
bye. Bye.